Felix Avenue, lights in a silent row. Pages of a living city where the signals start to glow. Two steady hands draw a groove in the velvet of the thread.
Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. We are diving deep today into one of the most, fundamental and really elegant design challenges in all of molecular biology.
Which is?
How does a cell maintain absolute precision when it's modifying its own instruction manual?
That precision is everything, you know? Think about your entire genome. You have meters of DNA, and it's all tightly spooled up inside the nuclear.
And to get at any gene, to activate it, that spool has to loosen.
Exactly. It has to transform from this dense kind of inert chromatin into open active DNA that's ready for transcription.
And the classic signal for that transformation is acetylation, specifically the acetylation of histone H3.
It acts like a crucial switch, an immediate one. It neutralizes the positive charge on the histone tails, and that forces the chromatin to physically relax and open up.
But that brings us to this huge problem of specificity.
Huge. Histone H3 is just covered in lysine residues. They're all potential targets for this acetylation, and many of them are, you know, almost identical chemically.
So if the enzyme is imprecise, you get chaos.
Absolute chaos. You get genes turning on when they shouldn't.
So how does one specific enzyme, like this NUA3 complex we're looking at, how does it manage to be so exquisitely precise? Choosing only lysine 14 on histone H3 every single time.
Yeah, it's like asking a chef to use only one specific grain of salt in a kitchen full of salt shakers.
What is the molecular choreography behind that? What subtle structural feature is driving this flawless selection?
And understanding that mechanism, well, it isn't just academic, that specificity controls the entire regulatory network of the cell.
When genes activate, how DNA repair works.
How the cell cycle proceeds. It's the molecular fingerprint of control, and honestly, until very recently, the atomic level details of why NUA3 is so loyal to H3K14, well, they remained a structural mystery.
Well, it seems the mystery has been solved, thanks to some really phenomenal structural biology. Before we unpack the mechanism, let's give credit where it's due.
Absolutely. Today we're celebrating the work of Wenping Shi, Lixia Zhao, Yuru Wang, Yi Zheng, Simiao Lu, Yanan Wang, Roger D. Kornberg, and Hekyo Zheng.
Their paper in Nature Communications really provided these groundbreaking mechanistic insights into histone recognition and H3K14 acetylation by the NEA3 histone acetyltransferase complex.
So to set the stage, let's just quickly remind ourselves of the environment where all this is happening. We're talking about chromatin.
Right, where DNA is wrapped around these fundamental protein structures called nucleosomes.
And at the core of that is an octamer of histone protein.
Okay, and hanging off those rigid cores are these flexible, unstructured N-terminal histone tails.
Exactly, and those tails are like the cellular equivalent of billboards. They're just covered in post-translational modifications, or PTMs.
Things like methylation, acetylation.
Right, and these PTMs, altogether, they form what we call the histone code. And that dictates who gets access to the DNA underneath.
And the enzyme in the spotlight today, the NEA3 complex, is a histone acetyltransferase, a HAT. This one is from budding yeast.
It's a really important member of the widely conserved MYS family of HATs. And, you know, NOA3 isn't just a single protein. It's this complicated dynamic machine made of six different subunits.
SAS3, INA1, YING1, EVE6, TAF14, and PDP3.
Right. And we know that SAS3 is the catalytic core. It's the one that actually does the acetylation. But the enzyme doesn't just operate in a vacuum.
So you're saying it has a kind of cellular GPS system.
Precisely. We already knew that NOA3 is conditionally dependent. It doesn't just randomly go around acetylating H3K14.
It has to be recruited first.
It has to be recruited to the right genomic spot based on marks that are already there. For instance, the YING1 subunit specifically recognizes H3K4 trimethylation,
which helps kickstart gene transcription.
And then the PDP3 subunit, it recognizes a different mark, H3K36 trimethylation, which is linked to keeping transcription going during the elongation phase.
So the complex is told where to go by the context of the existing modifications.
Yes. But once that whole six subunit machine arrives at the right address, the critical question is still there. How does SAS3, the catalytic part, make sure it lands that acetyl group only on lysine 14 and not any other lysine nearby?
And that is a purely structural problem. Solving it required, a very high-tech molecular camera.
Which brings us to the core method that unlocked this whole secret. the incredible visualizing power of cryo-electron microscopy.
Cryo-EM.
Cryo-EM was absolutely essential here. This is a large, dynamic, multi-subunit complex. Trying to crystallize it for X-ray studies would be, well, nearly impossible.
So the researchers had to first co-express and then meticulously purify all six of these subunits.
Which is a massive biochemical undertaking right there, just to get a stable assembly.
And then they ran into one of structural biology's classic headaches.
Preferred orientation. Exactly. I mean, imagine you're trying to take millions of photos of a tiny object, but every single time you take a picture, it's lying down on the same side. You only get one angle.
You can't reconstruct the full 3D shape from that.
You can't. So to solve this, the team did something innovative. They added a tiny amount of detergent, tween 20, during the sample prep.
And that little change was the key.
It was the key. It overcame the preferred orientation, let the complex tumble around on the grid, and gave them enough different views for a high-quality reconstruction map.
And that one technological fix gave them three incredible snapshots of the NUA3 complex in different states.
The first two captured the structure of the complex, you know, empty, and then bound just to the cofactor, acetyl coenzyme A.
The donor molecule that carries the acetyl group.
That's the one. But the most revealing structure was the third one, the full complex bound to both the acetyl-CoA and a synthetic histone H3 tail peptide.
The actual substrate.
The actual substrate. And this high-resolution image finally gave us the blueprint for specificity.
Okay, let's unpack these findings. This is where the molecular elegance really shines. The first major discovery wasn't even about the catalytic subunit, SAS3. It was about the shape of the binding site itself.
That's right. When they compared NUA3 to other related HATs like NUA4, which modifies a different histone, they found this really stark difference.
NUA4 has a shallow binding site.
A relatively shallow site, formed mostly by its own catalytic subunit. But in NUA3, it has a deep cooperative histone H3 tail binding cleft.
And cooperative means it's a team effort, right?
Absolutely. This deep cleft is formed jointly by the catalytic subunit, SAS3, and a non-catalytic subunit, N2-1.
So that cooperation is the first level of specificity.
It is. Instead of a simple groove, they build this custom-tailored tunnel that only the H3 tail can thread through properly. N2-1 acts as an architectural guide, making sure the tail is perfectly positioned before SAS3 can even think about doing its job.
That's fantastic. It's a filter based purely on shape. Now, what about the fuel, the acetyl-CoA? Where does it bind, and does its presence change anything?
So the acetyl-CoA, it binds very securely to the catalytic domain of SAS3. It's stabilized by all these polar interactions with specific amino acid residues there. And what's really fascinating is the dynamic nature of the complex. The enzyme doesn't just sit there waiting.
So the act of binding the acetyl-CoA actually primes the machinery.
It does. They observe that the enzyme dynamically shifts before the histone tail even arrives.
Wow.
Yeah, specific loops and helices inside SAS3 rearrange, and that effectively opens the binding cleft just a little bit. We're talking about a physical shift of a few tenths of a nanometer.
Which is not a huge movement, but sounds absolutely critical.
Utterly critical.
But doesn't that risk it becoming promiscuous? I mean, it's changing shape before the substrate is even confirmed.
That's where the precision of the shape and that cooperative binding really comes into play. This shift is more like cocking the hammer of a gun.
Okay.
Or tightening a spring. It sets the perfect geometry for the catalytic residue, glutamate 452, to be perfectly oriented for the chemical transfer of the acetyl group.
It's a preparatory dance.
It is. It optimizes the reaction kinetics, making sure that when the H3 tail finally docks correctly, everything is aligned for immediate specific acetylation at K14.
So we have the cooperative pocket from SAS3 and N1, and we have the enzyme priming itself. But the absolute killer finding, the thing that guarantees H3K14 specificity against all the other lysines, it comes down to one single tiny amino acid.
That is the hydrophobic anchoring mechanism, and it is centered entirely around glycine 13.
G13.
A key hydrophobic core formed by both SAS3 and NO1 anchors the part of the histone tail just before the target lysine. But the residue immediately preceding that target K14 is that tiny glycine 13.
Why is glycine 13 so special? What's the deal with glycine?
Glycine is the smallest of all amino acids. It just has a hydrogen atom as its side chain. It's tiny. Now look at the other lysine sites on H3 that NUA3 doesn't touch, like K9, K18, or K27.
What's next to them?
What residue precedes those sites? A much larger, much bulkier arginine.
Ah, so the binding pocket is specifically sized to accommodate that lack of bulk. It's a molecular sieve.
Exactly. It demands the smallest possible key. And the researchers proved this experimentally. They mutated that glycine 13 into an arginine, a G13R mutation.
And what happened?
When they did that, the HAT activity of NetEA3 just plummeted. It almost disappeared.
And why?
Because the pocket designed by SAS3 and N2-1 is extremely tight. If you replace that tiny glycine with the larger arginine, the side chain simply cannot fit.
It causes what structural biologists call a steric clash.
A significant steric clash. For anyone who doesn't visualize this stuff daily, imagine trying to fit a custom high-security key into a lock. The key is perfectly minimal.
Right.
Now imagine you tape a bulky square peg onto that key. It's just not going into the keyhole. That larger arginine takes up too much space and it physically bumps into key residues in both SAS3 and N2-1.
Which prevents the whole H3 tail from sitting deep enough for K14 to even reach the catalytic site.
Precisely.
That is a beautiful mechanism.
Yeah.
So SAS3 provides the enzymatic power, N2-1 provides the architectural precision.
And glycine 13 provides the molecular ID. It ensures only the correct substrate and the correct orientation gets acted upon. The whole system is built on these really elegant geometrical constraints.
It really reveals how crucial that local sequence context is for enforcing the histone code.
It does. The cooperative class 3 into 1 cleft isn't just binding the H3 tail, it's actively filtering out any tail that doesn't have that tiny little residue at the -1 position.
Now let's zoom out a bit. This work was done in yeast. But this family of HATs is conserved all the way up through eukaryotes. So what does this tell us about human biology?
It has profound implications. The NUA3 complex is structurally related to really important human complexes, particularly the BRPF12-HBO1 complexes.
Okay.
And although the researchers couldn't resolve the human structures experimentally, they used the yeast structure as a template to guide predictions using AlphaFold 3.
And what did those computational predictions show about our own machinery?
They showed a strikingly similar overall architecture. And crucially, BRPF1 and BRPF2, which are the human homologs of N2-1, they were predicted to contain a specific, structurally conserved FXN loop.
So that suggests?
It strongly suggests that this cooperative substrate engagement, where both the catalytic and the non-catalytic subunits work together, it's a fundamental ancient strategy. It's conserved from yeast all the way up to humans.
So our own gene regulation likely uses this two-key security system. It relies on both the active site and this architectural scaffold to maintain specificity.
That structural conservation is incredibly valuable knowledge for researchers, but, you know, we also have to acknowledge the limits of this study.
Right.
We mentioned earlier that NUA3 gets recruited based on two different pre-existing marks, H3K4ME3 and H3K36ME3.
Which define its two functional forms, NUA3A for initiation and NUA3B for elongation.
Exactly. And the subunits responsible for reading those marks, the Young1 PhD domain and the PDP3 subunit, they weren't actually resolved in these cryo-EM maps. They were probably too flexible, too disordered to image properly.
So while we know in atomic detail how NUA3 performs the acetylation,
right. We don't yet have the structural information on how the recruitment modules bind their respective marks on the nucleosome. And crucially, if that binding causes some different conformational change in the complex that sort of dictates its function.
NUA3A versus NUA3B.
Yeah. Those structural differences, that unseen mission control that guides its function, that remains the frontier for future research.
So if we step back, what is the core insight you want our listeners to walk away with from this deep dive?
I think the central lesson is that the specificity of a critical enzyme like NUA3 isn't just determined by its catalytic subunit alone. It relies on a deep cooperative binding pocket formed by the teamwork of the catalytic SAS3 and the architectural N2-1 subunit.
And this precise recognition is just exquisitely sensitive to the immediate local sequence around the target. It shows that a single non-reactive amino acid, that tiny glycine 13, is the crucial geometric determinant.
It enforces specificity. It effectively prevents the enzyme from damaging or incorrectly modifying the entire histone code.
This knowledge really shifts our perspective, especially when you think about therapeutics targeting these chromatin modifiers.
It does. We've always focused on the active site of the catalytic enzyme. But this research forces a critical question. What does this mean for drug design targeting HAT complexes, knowing that the non-catalytic subunits are just as essential for recognizing and positioning the substrate?
Yeah, if you design an inhibitor that only targets the active pocket of SAS3,
you're missing the crucial recognition interface from N2-1. your inhibitor might completely fail to prevent the reaction in a real cellular context.
So the future therapeutics will have to depend on designing multi-domain inhibitors that target both the catalytic engine and the specificity architecture.
It's no longer about just killing the catalyst. It's about disrupting the entire recognition system. It forces us to appreciate that complexity, even at the molecular level.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Midnight on the Helix Avenue, lights in a silent row. Pages of a living city where the signals start to glow. Two steady hands draw a groove in the velvet of the thread. One maps the doorway open, one keeps the rhythm fed. I hear the code in footsteps, I feel the lock alarm. A tiny hinge of nothing turns a maybe into my leaning. Don't rush, let the pattern speak. Close enough to touch what the eyes can't see. Every heartbeat in the margin, every breath in the seam. A narrow little passage makes the whole. Pocket 40, light it where the line is clean. Not every market's in tonight, only the one that fits just right. Move when the cofactor calls, dance in the shadow of the walls. Click, lock, spark at 14. Write the change on what we've been. A river of quiet, acetyl fire, running fingertip fast. Through a carved out canyon where the future meets the past. Hydrophobic hush, then a silver threaded hold. Backbone, a backbone, a story being told. If you swap that tiny hinge for something bright and wide, the doorway starts to stumble, the moment can't decide. Lean in, don't rush, let the pattern speak. Close enough to touch what the eyes can't see. When the room shifts a fraction, when the angle finally clears, the truth arrives in motion, not in noise or fear. Click, lock, spark authority, light it where the line is clean. Not every market's in tonight, only the one that fits just right. Move when the cofactor calls, dance in the shadow of the walls. Click, lock, spark authority, write the change on what we've been. A small exact permission, traced by careful hands in the frostlit frame of seeing. In the hush before the heat, I watch the world retune itself. Precise restraint complete, so keep it subtle, keep it sharp. Keep the rhythm on us too, because the smallest neighbor decides what power can do. Click, lock, spark at 14, lift it like a bright machine. Not every market's in tonight, only the one that fits just right. Move when the cofactor calls, dance in the shadow of the walls. Click, lock, spark at 14, turn the key and let it sing. It sing, it sing. Spark your 40.